here was the MIT professor Nicholas Negroponte. Did you know those things you were talking about would actually happen?
I had no question whatsoever. Of course they would happen. In fact, some of the things I was talking about were pretty old.
A few months after that appearance, Nicholas Negroponte would create the MIT Media Lab. And when he spoke at TED in 1984, Nicholas was making predictions about our future.
I'm talking here a little bit about display technologies. Let me talk about how you might input information. And my favorite example is always fingers. I'm very interested in touch-sensitive displays, high-tech, high-touch. And a lot of people think that fingers are very low-resolution, sort of stylus. In fact, they're not. You have to just do it twice. You have to sort of touch the screen and then rotate your finger slightly. And you can move a cursor with great accuracy.
Again, this was 1984. Fingers on a screen.
One advantage is that you don't have to pick them up. And people don't realize how important that is, not having to pick up your fingers to use them.
Okay, so fast forward more than 20 years, 2007. The best smartphones still needed a stylus to operate the touchscreens. Until...
Oh, a stylus, right? We're going to use a stylus. No. No. Who wants a stylus? You have to get them and put them away and you lose them. Yuck. Nobody wants a stylus. So let's not use a stylus.
Steve Jobs... introducing the iPhone at the 2007 Macworld convention.
And another advantage, of course, of using fingers is you have 10 of them.
And it's almost as if Steve Jobs had been there with Nicholas Negroponte in that auditorium that day in 1984.
We're going to use the best pointing device in the world. We're going to use a pointing device that we're all born with. We're born with 10 of them. We're going to use our fingers. We're going to touch us with our fingers.
Nicholas made an astounding number of predictions in that 1984 TED Talk, predictions that all came true.
Where we're trying to use computer and video disc technology now to come up with a new kind of book, a teleconferencing system where you had five people in teleconference such that each one was utterly convinced that the other four were physically present. A very recent experiment that we've been doing, in this case in Senegal, we have tried to use personal computers as a pedagogical medium.
Computers in classrooms, Skype video calls, FaceTime, e-readers, the Kindle, all these things Nicholas Negroponte predicted years, decades before they happened. The question is how? How did he know?
I remember giving talks on touch-sensitive displays, and people would argue against them. And the most prominent reason was that your fingers would get it dirty. Literally, I promise you. And Steve Jobs knew all of this. You know, this happens over and over again. I had to give a speech, actually, recently to something called the World Future Society. And in my opening remarks, I said one of the few advantages of age when you talk about the future is that you've been there so many times. So when people tell me things like, well, paper books will exist forever, rubbish. I know that. I remember telling Bertelsmann all the music will be on the network. Rubbish. They thought it would be on CDs and people would buy CDs forever. But you knew it. And, you know, these things do come back again.
Today on the show, TED speakers who are so ahead of the game, it's like they're predicting the future. A future so innovative that if it comes true, we'll make almost everything more interesting, more fun. But a warning, some of this stuff will freak you out, just a tiny bit. So right now, in a lab in New York City, a tissue engineer named Nina Tandon is experimenting with human cells. Now imagine taking those cells from your heart or your liver and then growing a new heart and a new liver identical to the ones you have. That's where Nina's research is headed, which she described in her TED Talk.
I work in a lab where we take cells out of their native environment, and we feed them sterilely, of course, with what we call cell culture media, which is like their food, and we grow them in incubators. But what we're really trying to do in my lab is to engineer tissues out of them. What does that even mean? Well, it means growing an actual heart, let's say, or grow a piece of bone that can be put into the body. Let's take the example of the heart, the topic of a lot of my research. What makes the heart unique? Well, the heart beats rhythmically, tirelessly, faithfully. We copy this in the lab by outfitting cell culture systems with electrodes. These electrodes act like mini pacemakers to get the cells to contract in the lab.
And so if you can copy those two things in the technology that you use to grow the cells in the lab, you can get pretty far with tricking them into believing they're inside the body and therefore behaving much closer to the way they would behave in a petri dish than they would otherwise.
How far are we from growing spare parts for our bodies?
Well, the heart is pretty tough, but actually we're just in the beginning stages of a startup right now where we're growing bones for skeletal reconstruction. So living, personalized human bones in the right shape and with the right cells. And the idea of growing organs and growing spare parts for the human body, I like to call this the idea of body 3.0, is spare living parts for the human body, because actually they're not just parts anymore. They fully integrate back into the body.
I mean, this could end that whole system of organ donations.
Yeah, and if you think about organs where the lines for transplants are so long, people die waiting, this is huge.
Okay, so if that idea doesn't blow your mind, just wait for this one. Tissue engineering that may lead to personalized medicine, made-to-order drugs for each and every person. Here's more from Nina Tandon's TED Talk.
Well, let's think about the drug screening process for a moment. You go from drug formulation, lab testing, animal testing, and then clinical trials, which you might call human testing, before the drugs get to market. It costs a lot of money, a lot of time. And sometimes, even when a drug hits the market, it acts in an unpredictable way and actually hurts people. And the later it fails, the worse the consequences. It all boils down to two issues. One, humans are not rats. And two, despite our incredible similarities to one another, actually those tiny differences between you and I have huge impacts with how we metabolize drugs and how those drugs affect us. So what if we had better models in the lab that could not only mimic us better than rats, but also reflect our diversity? Let's see how we can do it with tissue engineering. One of the key technologies that's really important is what's called induced pluripotent stem cells. They were developed in Japan pretty recently. They're a lot like embryonic stem cells, except without the controversy. We induce cells, okay, say skin cells, by adding a few genes to them, culturing them, and then harvesting them. So they're skin cells that can be tricked, kind of like cellular amnesia, into an embryonic state. So without the controversy, that's cool thing number one. Cool thing number two, you can grow any type of tissue out of them. Brain, heart, liver, you get the picture, but out of your cells. So we can make a model of your heart, your brain, on a chip.
That idea is so incredible. I mean, you can imagine how that will revolutionize the history of the world. And you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, you're diagnosed with, let's say, an aggressive form of bone cancer. If this technology heads in the direction where you think it might be headed, like, how do you imagine that person might be treated?
I can imagine taking stem cells from that patient in addition to cancer cells from that patient, growing a piece of bone, probably growing maybe lymph tissue, breast tissue, and exposing those cells to certain types of drugs and seeing which ones would work best. I can also imagine developing cancer treatments that are specific to that cancer by using molecular biology techniques to actually make a targeted therapeutic for that patient. So it's kind of two things, you know, screening known drugs against those cancers, but then also possibly even in the future developing a new drug specifically for that cancer.
Essentially, you could clone a part of a person with cancer and just experiment on that person's clone. Just throw everything you have at it to see how it responds.
Yeah, and a person with cancer doesn't have a whole lot of time to waste and a whole lot of freedom to experiment on themselves. They really only have kind of one shot to try each and everything. And so time is of the essence.
It's interesting because right now, I mean, the way medicine works, it seems normal to us. Like there's a disease and a medication is developed for that disease and then everyone who has that disease takes that medication, but I guess that probably won't be the way we do things in the future.
In the past, we've just sort of taken a statistical approach. We say, okay, 50% of people with depression respond to this drug, so let's prescribe it to 100% of the people, and if it doesn't work, well, we'll try something else. That, in a way, is low-hanging fruit. As we think about more and more complicated diseases with complicated mechanisms, and if you consider that everybody's cancer is different, those kind of statistical methods don't work as well. They just don't.
So you can imagine actually creating like an individual medicine for one person that might not ever be used on anybody else.
You can definitely see that, for sure.
Going forward, tissue engineering is actually poised to help revolutionize drug screening at every single step of the path. Disease models making for better drug formulations, massively parallel human tissue models helping to revolutionize lab testing, reduce animal testing, and human testing in clinical trials. And individualized therapies that disrupt what we even consider to be a market at all. Essentially, we're dramatically speeding up that feedback between developing a molecule and learning about how it acts in the human body. Our process for doing this is essentially transforming biotechnology and pharmacology into an information technology, helping us discover and evaluate drugs faster, more cheaply, and more effectively. Thank you.
Nina Tandon, she's a TED Fellow and an electrical and biomedical engineer at Columbia University's Laboratory for Stem Cells and Tissue Engineering. Check out her full talk at ted.npr.org. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Back in a moment with more mind-blowing predictions.
I'm Robin Young. Summer's over. Resident chef Kathy Gunn says dig into fall greens like kale, Swiss chard, bok choy.
All of these greens are so nutritious. We're talking like a lot of calcium and potassium, vitamin A, C, and K. So you should eat a lot of these.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
WILO programming is made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, presenting Classics 1, Voyages, on Saturday, October 25th at 7:30 p.m. at Kreinert Center for the Performing Arts. Soloist Mary Leathers Chapman and Deborah Reichmeyer join the symphony for a musical voyage from Scotland's Hebrides to the Arabian world of Scheherazade.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and today's show is all about predictions, connecting the dots from everything we see around us today to what we might actually have in the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the human genome.
This is Richard Resnick on the TED stage. He runs a genetic software company, and behind him on the stage, a picture of 46 chromosomes.
If you zoom in on this genome, what you see, of course, is this double helix structure, the code of life spelled out with these four biochemical letters, or we call them bases, right? A, C, G, and T. How many are there in the human genome? 3 billion. And perhaps because of its size, a group of people, all, by the way, with Y chromosomes, decided that they would want to sequence it.
Which they did, an amazing scientific feat. They mapped the code that makes up all human DNA. Now, they're still trying to figure out what it means, but they already know what it could mean for the future.
The world has completely changed and none of you know about it.
So how is it going to change the world?
In a bunch of ways. The good news is it's going to help us immensely in treating cancer, because cancer is nothing more than a disease of the genome. It's a disease where one cell has certain changes which cause it to get a little bit worse, and then it reproduces. And by the time you've got a solid tumor, you've got this really heterogeneous population of cancerous cells. And if you sequence their genomes, they are a mess. And so right now, prior to genome sequencing, we're taking wild guesses at what the molecular basis of one's cancer is. And now going forward, what we're going to do is say, forget all of that. What is happening at the molecular level? Because this drug can target only those cancers that have the BRAF mutation, as an example.
So where is it headed? What can you imagine in 10 or 20 years or beyond?
Well, I think we will cure cancer. Genomics and sequencing at large will ultimately cure cancer. Whether that happens in 10 years or 50 years or more is difficult to say.
That's incredible. I mean, you can say that with total confidence?
Absolutely. At some point, we'll snuff it out. I mean, people will still develop cancer, certainly, unless we get into genetic engineering of humans, which is something we ought to talk about. But it will be curable.
So what about other diseases? I mean, could you detect those by sequencing genes?
Oh, that's not distant future. That's happening right now.
So here's little Nick. Nick shows up at the children's hospital with his distended belly like a famine victim. And it's not that he's not eating. It's that when he eats, his intestine basically opens up and feces spill out into his gut. So 100 surgeries later, right, he looks at his mom and says, "Mom, please pray for me. I'm in so much pain." His pediatrician happens to have a background in clinical genetics, and he has no idea what's going on, but he says, "Let's get this kid's genome sequenced." And what they find is a single point mutation in a gene responsible for controlling programmed cell death. So the theory is that he's having some immunological reaction to what's going on to the food, essentially, right? And so this informs, among other things, of course, a treatment for bone marrow transplant, which he undertakes, and after 9 months of grueling recovery, he's now eating steak with A1 sauce. The prospect of using the genome as a universal diagnostic is upon us today. It's here. And what it means for all of us is that everybody in this room could live an extra 5, 10, 20 years just because of this one thing.
So walk us like 10 years from now or 20 years from now. You go into your doctor's office and something's wrong. I mean, this is going to be a normal part of seeing the doctor in the future?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a new company called Oxford Nanopore now that has one of these sequencing machines. Instead of it taking up a whole room and costing $500,000, it's the size of an iPhone. And so it'll be so cheap to do this that it will become, you know, trivial. Why wouldn't we just have a look? And I think if you come to the hospital and you're sick, somebody's going to be looking at DNA.
How fast is this happening?
Faster than we can keep up with. You know, every week there's a new company, there's a new test, there's a new competitor trying to create space in this industry for genetic testing.
Consumer applications for genomics, they will flourish. Want to see whether you're genetically compatible with your girlfriend? Sure. DNA sequencing on your iPhone, there's an app for that. Personalized genomic massage, anyone? There's already a lab today that tests for allele 334 of the AVPR1 gene, the so-called cheating gene. So anybody who's here today with your significant other, just turn over to them and swab their mouth, send it to the lab, and you'll know for sure. Do you really want to elect a president whose genome suggests cardiomyopathy? Now think of it. It's 2016, and the leading candidate releases not only her 4 years of back tax returns, but also her personal genome. And it looks really good. And then she challenges all of her competitors to do the same. Do you think that's not going to happen? You think it would have helped John McCain? My father's father is one of 10 Resnick brothers. They all hated each other, right? And they all moved to different parts of the planet. So it's likely that I'm related to every Resnick that I ever meet, but I don't know. So imagine if my genome were de-identified, sitting in software, right? And a third cousin's genome was also sitting there, and there was software that could compare these two and make these associations. Would you be willing to meet your third cousin? And if we both say yes, voila, welcome to chromosomally LinkedIn, right?
This is amazing, but I mean, it's also a little bit scary.
Yeah, very scary. What we've discovered recently is that the entire genome of your baby in the mother's womb is circulating in the mother's blood. It's all there. With a simple blood draw, we can look at a baby's entire genome. So it's not so difficult to imagine looking at the same genes to try to understand whether your baby is going to have genes that are good for them. And so now you get into this very different world of designing babies by trial and error.
Is that science fiction, or do you think that that might be within the realm of human possibility?
No, it's technically possible right now. You could do that in a test tube. All the technology is available to do that today. It's up to us as a society to figure out whether we want to have that happen. The knee-jerk is, my God, no, it's going to be Gattaca, it's going to be everything that we hate. But, you know, I mean, I'm a short, bald Jewish guy with a bad back. If I could have had the choice to have genes that, you know, made my back not so painful and, you know, tall with broad shoulders and a long locks of hair well into my...
Ryan Gosling body.
Right. You know, I mean, why wouldn't you choose that? And so it's time to answer the question. And I'm not taking a side on this question, but this is now a question that our society in 2013 has to grapple with.
How long before the moment a baby comes into the world, like their genome is sequenced in the hospital, and we'll be able to know everything about that baby, about what will happen to that baby physically?
Less than 10 years. There's all sorts of discussions right now in the genetics community about, you know, sequencing babies upon birth and how that's going to affect healthcare in the future. The issue, of course, is sometimes you don't want to know. You don't want to know. And so how do you manage keeping that information in a place where the human can decide whether to look at it or not? As soon as you get into this question of genetics and whether, you know, a genome should be sequenced, then all these ethical questions come out about what that means for the individual.
Have you sequenced your own genome?
No.
Yeah, well, why not?
Because I don't want to know. I don't want to, you know, I mean, if I were sick, I would do it for a diagnostic reason, but not for a prognostic reason. And that's the advice that I would give to anybody. Because you may find a variant that suggests that you're going to get really sick with something terrible, and it may never happen. And anyway, now that it's out there, there are times when certain agencies, like a life insurance, can have the right to look at that and make a guess. And in a world where every digital breadcrumb you leave behind can be tracked and looked at and watched, I would rather not have that information out there.
If you had, you know, like a crystal ball and you could ask it anything about the field of genetic testing and you wanted to know something for sure, what would you ask it?
I guess I'd want to understand whether we're going to screw this one up. You know, I'd want to understand whether we can, in the 20, 50, 100-year future, whether we can wield this technology in a way that doesn't impinge upon people's basic human rights, but maximizes the benefits that could come from the technology. So where are we? What happened? How did we do? Is cancer still around? Is malaria been wiped out? Are babies still made the way that they're made today? I'd love to see how it all works out.
Richard Resnick, he runs a company called Genome Quest, which makes genomic software. You can hear his entire talk at TED.com. Okay, so up to this point, the future is looking pretty awesome. You know, all this incredible technology to cure disease and make us live better lives. But like the Force, there is, of course, a dark side, which is what Mark Goodman worries about. He used to be a beat cop with the LA Police Department, and now he studies the future of crime and terrorism.
Today I'm going to show you the flip side of all those technologies that we marvel at, the ones that we love. In the hands of the TED community, these are awesome tools which will bring about great change for our world. But in the hands of suicide bombers, the future can look quite different.
And Mark Goodman believes we all caught a glimpse of that future in November 2008, when 10 men, just 10 men, brought a city of 20 million people to a standstill in Mumbai, India.
We're continuing to follow the deadly coordinated terror attacks there across the city. More than 80 people have been killed. Here's the latest report.
The men that carried that attack out were armed with AK-47s, explosives, and hand grenades. But heavy artillery is nothing new in terrorist operations. Guns and bombs are nothing new. What was different this time is the way that the terrorists use modern information communications technologies to locate additional victims and slaughter them.
So how did they do it?
What was different is that the terrorists innovated a terrorist op center. So at the very same time that the attack was taking place on the ground in Mumbai, there was an op center back in Pakistan monitoring in real time Al Jazeera.
The police have cordoned off all of the areas in South Mumbai.
CNN.
Reporting live from the scene as the Taj Hotel.
BBC.
What you're hearing is a lot of explosions.
As well as the internet. And they were culling all of that data for intelligence related to the attack and relaying that information to their terrorist operatives on the ground in real time. And that was something that we had never seen before.
The main target was a luxury hotel in downtown. It's called the Taj. And during the siege, the terrorists went from room
to room. And on the top floor of the Taj, there was a big suite.
They found a man hiding in his room. They tied him up and they interrogated him.
And they said to him, "Who are you and what are you doing here?"
"So I said I am a teacher."
This is that man, K.R. Ramamurthy.
Then they asked me, "Where from you come?" Then I said, "I come from Bangalore."
The terrorists were dumb, but they weren't that dumb. And they know that no Indian school teacher could afford to stay in the Taj, let alone in a suite.
They said, "What is your name?" I said, "K.R. Ramamurthy." But I didn't realize at the time they are doing Google search.
And what did they do? Using their smartphones, phoned it into their terrorist operations center. And they began an open source intelligence search for the man. They were able to locate a photograph which matched the name. And then over the phone, they did a match comparison.
Then back came the question from them.
The terrorist op center asked the terrorist on the ground, "You're hostage."
"Is he bald in his head?"
"Is he bald in front?"
They said, "Yes."
"Yes, he is."
"Is he wearing a spectacles?"
"Wearing glasses."
Then they said, "Yes."
"Is he heavy set?"
"Is he heavy built?" They said, "Yes." Which would mean it is at that stage, possibly they identified who am I.
The op center had a match, and they saw that K.R. Ramamurthy was actually a top executive at a bank. And so when they figured that out, what did they tell the gunman?
I think they told him he's an important person. And kill him the moment your life is under danger.
Obviously, K.R. Ramamurthy survived. A blast in another part of the hotel distracted the terrorists, and he was able to escape. But Mark Goodman thinks that what happened in that hotel in Mumbai was almost like a template for the future of crime and terrorism.
We've all seen 3D printers. We know with them that you can print in many materials. But I wonder, for those people that strap bombs to their chests and blow themselves up, how might they use 3D printers? We recently saw a case where some researchers made the H5N1 avian influenza virus more potent. And the researchers who did this were so proud of their accomplishments, they wanted to publish it openly so that everybody could see this. In the United States, there are 60,000 people who have a pacemaker that connects to the internet. All of the physical objects in our space are being transformed into information technologies. Criminals understand this, terrorists understand this, hackers understand this. If you control the code, you control the world. This is the future that awaits us.
And you say, this is the future that awaits us. And I saw that and I thought, that is not a future I want to be a part of. Like, that is frightening.
It could and perhaps should be cause for concern. The goal is not to be alarmist. I am a huge proponent of technology, a work in Silicon Valley, but we are leading a life that is increasingly disintermediated through technology. We don't talk to people face-to-face anymore. We used to reach out to them on a telephone and then on a computer, and now it's on an iPhone, an iPad. When we look at our cars today, the speedometer is not a manual speedometer. It's a computer. When you go into the hospital and they check your heart, that is a computer that is checking your heart. When pilots on aircraft look at their navigational signals and instruments, that's all a computer. And the one thing that we know is that there has never been built a computer system that could not be hacked. So when I look out into the future and see the technological horizon and the increased dependence upon technology, and knowing that all technology to date is fundamentally insecure, I do have some growing concerns about that future.
What to do? What to do about all this? That's what I get asked all the time. Policing doesn't scale globally, at least it hasn't. And our current system of guns, border guards, big gates, and fences are outdated in the new world into which we're moving. Whether or not you realize it, we are at the dawn of a technological arms race. An arms race between people who are using technology for good and those who are using it for ill. The threat is serious, and the time to prepare for it is now. I can assure you that the terrorists and criminals are. My personal belief is that rather than having a small elite force of highly trained government agents here to protect us all, we're much better off having average and ordinary citizens approaching this problem as a group and seeing what we can do. If we all do our part, I think we'll be in a much better space. The tools to change the world are in everybody's hands. How we use them is not just up to me, it's up to all of us.
Mark Goodman, check out more of his predictions in his TED Talk. Find it at ted.npr.org. Stay with us. More predictions about our future in just a moment. I'm Guy Raz. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from MD Anderson Cancer Center. 70 years dedicated to one goal, making cancer history. Learn more at makingcancerhistory.com. From Constant Contact, committed to helping nonprofits with email marketing, events, and social in one toolkit. More at constantcontact.com. And from Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Outback. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
Illinois Public Media, in partnership with WCIX 49 and the News Gazette, present the Illinois 13th Congressional District Debate between incumbent Republican Rodney Davis and Democratic challenger Ann Callis. WCIA 3's Jennifer Roscoe will moderate the debate, broadcast live from the WILL studios. Tune in tonight at 7 for the Illinois 13th Congressional District Debate on WILL-TV, AM 580, and FM 90.9.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose initiative on immigration presents How Immigrants Became Americans, The Case of the Poles, by Jim Barrett, on Monday, October 20th at noon at the Center for Advanced Study, 912 West Illinois Street, Urbana.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today's show is all about predicting the future. So GPS, pretty amazing, right? It's totally changed road trips forever. But for our next guest, GPS is a lot more than that. It's about the future of privacy, which, as you will hear, may not exist.
I'm Todd Humphreys. I'm an aerospace engineering professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the director of the Radio Navigation Laboratory here at UT.
I mean, you're a GPS guy.
That's right.
Do you ever use paper maps?
I love paper maps.
But do you use them?
I still use them.
You use them, really?
Of course. I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon for me personally, but I see it going away for the community at large pretty fast.
To understand what got us here, why paper maps have become virtually extinct, you have to go back to May 2nd, 2000.
And that was the day that ushered in this explosion of applications of GPS.
And that just happened like that.
It was. It was magical.
Officials at the White House today announced that civilians will be able to find their way in the world a bit more easily after tonight.
The change was silent, imperceptible unless you knew exactly what to look for. U.S. President Bill Clinton ordered that a special switch be thrown in the orbiting satellites of the Global Positioning System. Instantaneously, every civilian GPS receiver around the globe went from errors the size of a football field to errors the size of a small room. It's hard to overstate the effect that this change in accuracy has had on us. Before this switch was thrown, we didn't have in-car navigation systems giving turn-by-turn directions, because back then, GPS couldn't tell you what block you were on, let alone what street. This level of accuracy has unleashed a firestorm of innovation. The holy grail, of course, is the GPS dot. Do you remember the movie The Da Vinci Code? Here's Professor Langdon examining a GPS dot, which his accomplice tells him is a tracking device accurate within 2 feet anywhere on the globe. But we know that in the world of nonfiction, the GPS dot is impossible, right? For one thing, GPS doesn't work indoors. And for another, they don't make devices quite this small, especially when those devices have to relay their measurements back over a network. Well, these objections were perfectly reasonable a few years ago, but things have changed. There's been a strong trend toward miniaturization, better sensitivity. Compare that with the device released just months ago that's now packaged into something the size of a key fob. Imagine what we could do with a world full of GPS dots. It's not just that you'll never lose your wallet or your keys anymore, or your child when you're at Disneyland. You'll buy GPS dots in bulk, and you'll stick them on everything you own worth more than a few tens of dollars.
So this is something that is just going to be normal, like, who knows, 10, 5, 10, 20 years from now. We won't lose anything anymore.
That's right. I see this as moving what we are accustomed to in the cyber world into the physical world. We'll be able to search our possessions just as we search emails and pull up something that's old and still useful and figure out where it was.
So this is incredible. I mean, I can't see why I wouldn't. Actually, you know what? I can see some reasons why I wouldn't want it. Now that I think about it, there are lots of reasons why you wouldn't want it.
Well, that's what I call the flip side. As soon as you try to extract utility from knowing exactly where you are or where your things are, you're giving away a lot about who you are and where you travel. But this is just a symptom of our connected world. And when we want somebody to predict our actions so that it can be useful for us, you know, tell us when the traffic's going to be high or when we can expect rain in a certain area, we want those predictors to know our patterns. But what's more private than our exact location? That's about as private as it gets.
Can you imagine a future in which governments, our government, could easily track us and make it a regular thing that it does?
You know, what's most interesting in the aftermath of the Edward Snowden revelations is that the metadata that the government requested from Verizon did include position data, but the government didn't make any use of it, even though they admitted legally they could have. And for me, that's not much of a barrier to them going ahead and making use of our position data. I see this as, if not a foregone conclusion, it's going to be an irresistible temptation for the government to find out where we are and what we were doing. We are selling our privacy for convenience. And everyone is doing this every day a little bit more, a little bit more. If at one moment you wake up and you're wanting to reclaim your privacy, you'll have to do that by relinquishing a lot of conveniences you've come to depend on.
In your TED Talk, you mentioned something called a GPS spoofer.
That's right.
Which could do serious damage.
The idea behind the GPS spoofer is simple. Instead of jamming the GPS signals, you imitate them. And if you do it right, the device you're attacking doesn't even know it's being spoofed. Up until very recently, nobody worried about GPS spoofers. People figured that it would be too complex or too expensive for some hacker to build one. But I and a friend of mine from graduate school, we didn't see it that way. And we wanted to be the first to build one so we could get out in front of the problem and help protect against GPS spoofing. Now, the Dr. Frankenstein moment, when the spoofer finally came alive and I glimpsed its awful potential, came late one night when I tested the spoofer against my iPhone. And this little blue dot started at my house and went running off toward the north, leaving me behind. I wasn't moving. What I then saw in this little moving blue dot was the potential for chaos. I saw airplanes and ships veering off course, with the captain learning only too late that something was wrong. I saw the GPS-derived timing of the New York Stock Exchange being manipulated by hackers. You can scarcely imagine the kind of havoc you could cause if you knew what you were doing with a GPS spoofer.
This is like a crazy, like, disaster movie.
It was for me, too, that night. And the truth is that in the year that's passed since that TED Talk, there's been nothing to dissuade me from seeing that as a potentially awful future where we can't trust the devices that are telling us where we are.
Within the next few years, many of you will be the proud owner of a GPS dot. The GPS dot will fundamentally reorder your life. But will you be able to resist the temptation to track your fellow man? Or will you be able to resist the temptation to turn on a GPS spoofer to protect your own privacy? What we see just beyond the horizon is full of promise and peril. It'll be fascinating to see how this all turns out. Thanks.
Todd Humphries is a professor at UT Austin. Check out his whole talk at ted.npr.org. Tell me what you imagine the average commute to be like in 50 years.
Well, you can test it out today. Just get yourself a cab driver and then read the newspaper, fall asleep, text, spend your time better. And then imagine the car driving itself without a taxi driver.
In other words, a driverless car. And Sebastian Thrun is one of the engineers behind Google's model. Now, in some ways, that future of commuting is already here, at least for Sebastian, who's got his own driverless car.
When I take it to Lake Tahoe with my wife, I can either drive myself as a human driver or I can have the car drive me. And my wife usually begs me to let the car drive. Why? She actually feels safer. If you look at the ability of a self-driving car to stay in the lane and not to speed and keep a good distance to the car in front of you, it actually does better than me.
We're talking about a future in which potentially there are no accidents.
That would be fantastic. If we could do away with traffic accidents, that'd be wonderful. It'd be more than 1 million people saved every year on this planet.
Driving accidents are the number one cause of death for young people. And do you realize that almost all of those are due to human error and not machine error and can therefore be prevented by machines? Do you realize that we could change the capacity of highways by a factor of two or three if we didn't rely on human precision on staying in the lane, but on robotic precision and thereby drive a little bit closer together, on a little bit narrower lanes, and do away with all traffic jams on highways?
It sounds totally amazing. So how does it work?
Well, it works by putting basically a computer into the driver's seat, so to speak, and adding robotic eyes, mostly on the roof of the vehicle, actually. And they have this nice property that can actually measure how far things are away. There's no texting, there's no distraction, they're always awake, and they always see everything.
You could imagine a future in which, I don't know, you would go on a road trip across the country, and you would strap yourself into, like, a bed and fall asleep.
Yeah.
While the car drove through the night.
Just like a train.
Wow.
We do this with trains all the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it had the same convenience as a car because it would bring you exactly to where you want to go.
So everybody would have their own, like, personal chauffeur.
I think it would be great. Honestly, the average American spends about 52 minutes a day in commute traffic. And as much as I love driving my car, and many people like driving their car, commute has never been fun for me. So if I could, like, shave off these 52 minutes a day, I could be significantly more productive.
This is 4 billion hours wasted in this country alone, and it's 2.4 billion gallons of gasoline wasted. Now, I think there's a vision here, a new technology, and I'm really looking forward to a time when generations after us look back at us and say how ridiculous it was that humans were driving cars.
What more needs to happen now? I mean, how do you make the technology better, or is it already there?
So we have to really get to the point where the technology is much more reliable. We have one incident every 50,000 or so miles. And if you had a chauffeur that would have one incident every 4 years, you would probably not like your chauffeur. And the cases that really concern us are all these rare things, like the deer on the highway. So there's enough of these really kind of, I call them freak situations out there that we have to fix before we can be confident. But once we get there, it's going to be really amazing.
We could save the planet and gasoline and lives, and we could maximize our time and be more efficient. And so, like, so when can I get one of these? I mean, how long?
I hope it's going to be less than 5 years.
Less than five years?
5 years in the internet age is the world, but 5 years in automotive age is actually not very much.
So you think that within 5 years, people will be sitting in the passenger seat while their car drives them to work?
And back.
Sebastian Thrun, he's one of the engineers behind the Google driverless car. Do you see yourself as a futurist?
I think that I'm a futurist by having felt that I've been there. So it's taking someplace where you are and you're doing and sort of looking out as to what it might mean further on. So it's a little bit like a traveler who's come back from being in a country.
And in that sense, Nicholas Negroponte has been traveling for years. As we mentioned earlier in the show, he spoke at the first ever TED conference in 1984. And he predicted touchscreens would be a big part of our lives someday.
Fingers. I'm very interested in touch-sensitive displays, high-tech, high-touch. And a lot of people think that fingers are very low-resolution sort of stylus for inputting to a display. In fact, they're not.
Why was Nicholas Negroponte at the front end of so much of this stuff? And how did his team at the MIT Media Lab predict with so much confidence so many of the things we'd be using?
I think we were very arrogant. In fact, people thought it was quite arrogant to suggest that this would be part of daily life. I was actually asked once to chair a session for an organization that doesn't even exist anymore. And I said I would if it could be called Computers in Daily Life. And they said, what do you mean? What is that? And so
how did you connect the dots? I mean, were you seeing what other researchers were doing?
Well, we did a great deal of it ourselves. We had access to one of the world's first continuous speech recognition systems. We had access to really one of the first very large screen, floor-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall displays. And we had access to a device that was done for fighter pilots, actually, that you could track its position in six dimensions, where it is in space. And we put the three of them together and made a system, perhaps one of the best I've ever been involved with in my life, where the user could stand in front of the screen, wear this thing on his or her wrist, and talk to the screen and say, put that there, with a gesture, and whatever was on the screen would move. So that's the sort of things we were doing back in the early and mid-70s.
But that technology never really took off. I mean, we don't use that today.
Well, we certainly use speech with Siri, and you use touch with a lot of things. Putting them together still is slightly behind, but there are some people starting to, because cell phones, everybody's looking for some kind of competitive edge, and there are people who are starting to use the camera now to look at you while you're looking at it. A lot more eye tracking will happen. Things will, again, this is pretty predictable in the next couple of years.
Do you think about the future a lot? I mean, about the things that'll change our world in, say, 10 or 20 years from now?
Well, I do spend time trying to think about what I cannot imagine. And whatever it is will be at the interface of silicon and biology. It's not going to be, you know, the iPhone 7 or the, you know, the Internet 2. And I think we're going to see things happen that are, you know, astonishing in terms of working at very, very small scales, going down to the nanotechnology world that is going to surprise us what people do. Some of the things happening in biology and genomics and proteomics, it's going to be extraordinary, and the changes are going to be huge.
Nicholas Negroponte is the founder of the MIT Media Lab. His amazing talk from 1984 is at ted.npr.org. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.